Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Kevin, guess what?
What, Rob?
We now have over 50 iTunes reviews.
Huzzah!
Huzzah, indeed! Oh. We are climbing those iTunes rating charts.
That's amazing. Yeah. How do we climb even higher?
Can you take me high enough? Little Rock of Ages for you.
Do you know I like that you took it up so high too? You didn't even, you like went right to the tenor place.
I was going
to
do
No Robert Goulet.
Like, no. Can you take me high enough?
Thanks for coming out tonight.
Ooh, and my falsetto there.
Thank you.
And a little Sergio Frankie?
Yeah, a little Sergio.
It's never over. Much like the 24-hour buffet down in the lobby of the Dunes Casino. Me and Sid the Caesar. Tonight's only at the Mirage. Sorry. Well, lovely listeners, this is where you come in. This is how we're going to climb those iTunes rating charts.
That's right. Lovely listeners, if you love us, would you go to iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on Ratings and Reviews. Under the Customer Reviews, click Write a Review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
That's right. And you can leave comments, too, like Kevin Thomas is a god.
Or, Rob, who the hell is Hervé Villechaize?
Who is Hervé
Villechaize?
I fell for it again.
You fell for it.
That wasn't even the script.
The man has never done one musical in his entire life, and he gets mentioned more than Stephen Sondheim.
Right, but I love him from James the Bond. Okay, anyway.
Oh, yes.
Guys, help us out.
Please. Thanks, everyone.
Hey, friends, and welcome to part one of our two-part interview with the wonderful, legendary Charles Strauss. Just wanted to give you a little information. Our computer did not record the first 5 minutes of this interview with Charles Strauss, so you've missed our intro, and you've missed Charles saying that he was born in New York City. So once you know that, you're good to go. Thanks so much, and enjoy this wonderful interview with this wonderful man.
Were you seeing theater while you were growing up?
Not much.
Not much.
No, my parents were... They didn't spend much money. I mean, my father was a and mother were both products of the Depression, and some money was so. No, we were not big theater goers. Saw a couple of things. They were very interested in it, and my father, since he was in the cigar business, he had a lot of friends in show business, and so I didn't meet songwriters.
Yeah,
I met Frank Lesser.
And
people like that. Through my father's connections, basically, and then got to know them. And
well, yeah. What happens after you leave Eastman?
After I leave Eastman, I was determined to continue on my serious music, and was working on a string quartet, and living at home, and my meals and my rent was paid for. And I was restless, and I didn't know exactly what to do. And then my father passed away, and we had a, my brother was away, my sister got married, and I was alone in this big apartment on the west side. And I suddenly got itchy. I had to get away. Both, I didn't know at the time what it was. And I did, and in doing that, I had to find work first to pay for an apartment and all of that, and that's what I did. I actually found a job at Movie Tone News, which I don't think people even know about now.
What is that?
There used to be newsreels shown in theaters along with the main features. I would say most of the theaters had them. They were the people who made the March of Time. I don't even know whether people know that, but there used to be a 10-12 minute feature called News of the Day. Somebody by the name of Lowell Thomas narrated it, and there were things like, I know these titles because I ultimately got hired and did music for things what we would be called Australian aquabells. And it was music that you wrote that had a lot of heartless on those, and of course then it could be easily cut.
Right.
Koreans on parade, things like that, and I mean newsreels.
Yeah.
But they don't have them anymore.
Wild.
But I did that. It was very tough in a way. I thought it would be easy because I'm a good faker, if you know what I mean. And
she said, totally.
Write a Chinese march, I could kind of,
yeah.
It wouldn't be very good. But when it came right down to doing it, I found it demanding.
Yeah.
And anyway, I spent over a year working under a, you know, the man who was the, it was under the guise of 20th Century Fox. They
sure.
used to do something called the March of Time and Movie Tone News. Wow. None of these are of our generation at all.
Oh, no, not anymore.
But it was good training for me.
Oh, yeah.
And then I was, well, you yourself are in this, so
yeah.
you understand that aspect. I became a rehearsal pianist,
yep.
a coach, and I worked for actors. And at the time, it was $5 an hour and $7 if I played their audition.
Wow.
Today, people tell me they pay $400.
It gets up there depending on who it is and
yeah.
all of that. Oh yeah, it's.
But I played for a lot of dancers and we went to auditions. I got more or less familiar with the theater.
That world, yeah.
Yeah.
Just to back up real quickly, because I have to ask about Aaron Copland. You worked with him at Tanglewood, is that
at
correct?
At Tanglewood and privately later, yes. In fact, there's a picture of him on my desk. I still keep him there. He uh-huh. looks at me sternly.
Can you tell me a little bit about your training with him and how that lasted a pretty long time, it seemed like?
I was, I think, 3 years at Tanglewood, and then I worked a little bit with him privately. I just loved Aaron, and he was a very gentle man who wrote, I thought, wonderful music, which became terribly out of fashion with the a certain class of musician.
Totally.
Yeah.
I feel like he got robbed a little bit.
He did, and he went along. He was a willing victim because he felt he had to become this breed of European that was coming in, that was
yeah.
writing very hard-edged music.
Yes.
And, but I loved his music originally, and I loved Aaron, and he was a good friend to me.
What did you? What kind of musical things did you learn from him?
Well, he was a very funny man in that respect. He was not an academician, yet he knew a lot about, you know, the technique of music and all. But he was kind of just about, you know. I've kind of heard that before, Charles, I think you can make more of that ending and make more of this. It was not. I've worked with other teachers who were atonalists,
uh-huh.
A number of them who were really good for me, you know, because I had to explain why I used an E flat there when I had used an E flat just a measure before, which was not the way I ever thought about music, but it taught me a certain respect for why I would repeat the E flat in a following measure, whereas I had never thought about that.
Yeah.
And so I worked with a number of them, particularly a man by the name of Arthur Berger, a very tough composer. And Aaron was more my style.
Yeah.
He was, you know, and Boulanger kind of sewed it up for me. I mean, she had and demanded an overview, including, as I mentioned, music I'd written when I was 4 and 5.
Right.
And she gleaned a lot from that.
Yeah, indeed. That's really special. It's incredible that you could have such great teachers that helped you with your serious music, but yet that translated so well to the Broadway. To the Broadway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's pretty special.
Yeah. Did you play acting classes at one point? Is that correct?
Yes, it's correct. I played for the Actors Studio. In fact, I was the Actors Studio pianist because musicals were becoming very popular. And all these famous actors like, I can't even think, Marilyn Monroe, Anne Bancroft, who were some of the big men stars? Everybody was studying with,
Lee Strasberg, yeah.
Lee Strasberg.
Oh, yeah.
And because I was a kind of popular pianist around town,
yeah.
I became the pianist for the Actor Studio, which was really an experience.
Oh, yeah. And I read somewhere that you introduced Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft.
I did.
Well done.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, good job. Yes. Yeah. Matchmaker, making a match.
What advice, was it Mr. Strasberg who said, the conductor should be following the actor? Is that right?
That was one of the many things he said. By the way, actors were enwrapped by every word he said. And I kind of sitting there, with my G diminished chord and saying, oh, wait a second, hold on, he came from the actor's truth,
right,
superseding any rhythmic requirements that a piece may have. And I don't feel that way at all.
Yes.
I feel that the actor has to adjust basically to the flow. And he was full of that. So, and I played all these, they would do scenes from Oklahoma or something with, I remember Marilyn Monroe was one of the, a lot of famous. Paul Newman was in the class.
And they were just practicing
musicals were coming in, and they all recognized that
they would get more work, maybe, or they would get good practice.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if Marilyn was Ado Annie or Laurie at this point.
I don't remember playing for her. Literally, I mean, she was always there,
right?
But I don't remember which particular scene played for her.
It was the most intense production of No, Nanette you've ever seen in your life. So many tears. I want to be happy. Just. So angsty.
I can imagine, though, it was like, I'm just a girl who can't feel it more.
Did you ever have a desire to act?
No.
You
No. Maybe secretly. I do remember when we were in summer stock. I spent 3 years at a place called Green Mansions.
Oh, yeah.
And one review, they needed an extra body with one line. I could do it now, blindfold, because I've become good among people. And I talk pretty much effortlessly, as we're doing now.
Yeah, indeed.
But it wasn't that way. And I had one part with one line, which I can remember now, which was, I was a detective who brought a suspect to the airport, and my line was, here he is, Mr. Black. Anything else I can do for you? It's funny, I remember it. But at that time in my life, with all my problems about my weight and who I was and everything else, and getting up in front of people was terrifying. And I remember that moment where I said, here. And the rest wouldn't come, and they finally pushed me off the stage in a cold sweat.
Oh.
But I've changed a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, oh, indeed. But,
yeah.
Wow.
We'll do a revival to get you back onto that one line.
That's funny. Reviews were very popular then, in the 50s and even the 40s, but you started out writing for a lot of reviews, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes. And specifically at that place, there was a place that was Green Mansions, and there was another place which was kind of in competition, which I can't remember now, and Mel Brooks.
And Grossinger's or no?
Not Grossinger's.
Tenement.
Can you tell us a little bit about, because that does not really exist anymore,
the Catskills,
going away for the summer and all of that. And
These were the Adirondacks.
Oh, the Adirondacks. Yes.
It was wonderful for everybody. At Green Mansions, there was a company that throughout the summer, which was, I guess, 10 or 12 weeks, of about 12 people, and every week they put on a new review, which meant that the composers would have to write 3 or maybe 4 songs.
Wow.
And the rest were comedy sketches that
right.
either were traditional or the comics up there made them up. And it was very demanding and very consuming, And I loved it. It was consuming in the way that we would have to write a song. And it was the way it was done. I would make the orchestration, copy the parts, and it would be in rehearsal and play it. I look back at it as some of the most fun times I ever had. It
must have been fun, but also great training, too.
Without knowing it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it was terrific.
Do you like deadlines? Do you like knowing, hey, it has to be finished by...
Well, you know, it's a tricky question. The superficial answer is no, it's very tough. But the best answer is they sometimes make you do your best work. Mm-hmm. If I stop and think about, gee, should it be that note or da, 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 da. But sometimes if you have to do something, it turns out well.
That's an astute point.
Yeah, totally.
How does the relationship with Lee Adams come about?
Lee and I met, he was the editor of a magazine. His main interest at that time was journalism, mm-hmm. and he was the editor of a Sunday issue of, I can't remember whether it was the Journal American or the Herald Tribune or something, but and that was his interest. He had graduated Columbia Journalism School, but written the college shows. And we got together through a friend, a mutual friend, and one Christmas time, and he wanted to write shows. And I had worked with Fred Ebb for a year, but we never wrote anything. In fact, some of the bad songs of all times we wrote together. And Lee and I hit it off, and he wanted to very much to have a career in music. His father, Lee's father, liked me very much, and I him, and he encouraged the friendship, and we fell in together and worked. And
How today we have the internet, we can find people with like minds. How did you find the same circles then?
You mean in the theater?
Yeah, in the theater world.
Well, you're really clawing your way to get to know people. I mean, nobody wanted to listen to Bye Bye Birdie, for instance. We couldn't get people in a room. We couldn't get people to, if you'd stop somebody on the street and say, there's a new show, will you just, we couldn't get anybody to hear that show. And I forget who became interested in it. The producer was always interested in it. We developed the idea with him. And how did it get on? Oh, Gower Champion, who had never done a show really.
Yeah.
We played it for him and Marge once. Why, I don't know. And he liked it. He was the first person who did.
Yeah.
He was not a big name. They had done films, Marge and Gower.
Yeah.
And when he came, we were playing auditions for anybody, and a man from Texas, Orange, Texas, by the name of Slade Brown.
Of course it was.
he was one of the people who came in for a backers audition, and it turned out he was filthy rich. And a real
oil money.
That's right. Yeah, his family owned oil barges, and he was a novice. And he came. He was just up in New York. We didn't know it at the time, and I hope I'm not dirtying his name, so to speak, in any way when I say many years later, because Slade and I became the best of friends. Mm. It turned out he was gay, mm-hmm. but he didn't know it, I don't think. Mm. But he came up to, he had a family and a wife, and he came up to New York, and he was the first person, and I thought to myself when we met him, he had a real thick drawl, boy, what a hick.
Mm.
And he asked to play, we played him the score and told the stories we always had at auditions, and he said it afterwards, I like those songs. It's some of that. And then he sat down at the piano. This is vivid in my mind. He sat down at the piano and he said, I like this one. And he played bum, 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 my ear. He said, what was that called again? I said, put on a happy face. He said, I like that. And he kind of doodled around. And it turned out that he was a novice musician. He had a big family. What I didn't know at the time was he was coming up here to change his life.
Oh, wow.
And he was with one other man who was carrying a briefcase. And it's a moment that is so vivid in my mind. And he said to the producer, how much do you need? And I remember Padula said, well, he said we could buy costumes and put up a bond. If we had $75,000 now, we could. He said, okay, turned to this man next to him, took out a checkbook from his briefcase, and he wrote us a check for $75,000. And it was like magic. I remember my mind going in Technicolor because we couldn't get anyone to hear it.
Yeah, no, it even took someone from Texas, yeah. Orange, yeah. Texas, to come
who
in
was
and
a
say,
total
hey.
Naive. And he said, how much you guys need? He knew nothing about it. And he wrote us a check at the time. My world turned to Judy Garland Technicolor.
Yeah.
And that's the way it started. And then after that, money did come in.
Wow.
And et cetera.
It's absolutely incredible.
We don't really have backers
auditions
anymore.
Thank you for bringing this up.
We do.
you don't? I think younger composers have other avenues that they explore nowadays.
Well, there are film connections. I never had them.
Totally. But in the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s, backers auditions are common, were common.
They were.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that process was like?
From the heart. I mean, because it's like spending years in a Roman galley. You had to play for a group of people, some with acknowledged money and even a history of backing shows, others just people for whom it was an afternoon's pleasure and they really had no big intention, and others who would consider it, but anybody who was really financially smart wouldn't do it.
Right.
But you'd have to get 10 people in a room, so to speak. And in fact, I'm going to do one next month on my new show. And it's very trying because you've never heard the material out loud. And you gather together, in this case, it's a very small show. There are only 5 people in it. So 5 people. And I have to write out all the music. In this particular case, I wrote the book music and lyrics. I've never done that before.
Yeah.
And then you play it for these people. And you get a really unfair reading, but which has a lot of elements of truth about it. Sometimes the reaction is explosively wonderful, and the show doesn't mean it. Other times, people just sit there and say, gee, that really sounds good. Let me look at the script. In my career, I would say there's almost no connection between what backers say is it and what really happens.
Huh. Mm.
There's a lot of very smart money who seem to be very good. There's a woman in London whose name I forget who... she does Andrew Lloyd Webber, people like that. She's very wise. I've met her, and I know a lot of the big backers now, and they all sit there, and I would say their batting average is like a major league baseball player with a bad year.
Totally.
Nobody I know, and I, you know, through my career, I've known people like David Merrick.
Yeah.
And I've never known. They say that Ziegfeld was, magic, and I've never seen a Ziegfeld show. But I know now, some big Hollywood producers and directors. I don't know anybody who knows. And the shows that Lee and I have had, or Martin and Tom and I have had, I would say it's maybe 60-40, with 60 being the naysayers. Mm-hmm. And the 40, and even then it may be 70-30.
Yeah.
The people who do ultimately do it based on the fact that I was charming during the audition,
right?
And which has nothing to do with
the
show.
Not the piece, yeah.
Or they're gamblers.
Yeah,
I would say there's more of them than not. I don't know anybody. And then a lot of people who have become famous who are just in a group of people, and I can't remember all their names, who they're the cream financially, and somehow the best people reach them. The Arthur Millers of the day, or of course Rodgers and Hammerstein finance their own shows. It's gambling. And most people who have money don't want to gamble it.
Right.
So these are people who have a little bit of romance in them. I would say, I don't know the numbers, but probably 60% of them lose their money.
Yeah. Mm. So they say it's a high risk, high yield.
It's a high risk.
High risk, high yield. But if it's, it's not every show is going to be an Annie.
And what it leans on in a way is an even trickier business, which is real estate. These people who own theaters, they pay a lot of tax, New York land, electricity, steam. So to give one of their theaters to a show, this is even after the show is financed, they're very hard-nosed about it, the Schuberts and those people. It's a very, very, because it goes into real estate.
Yeah,
and
to business, really. It's not about the art. It's about
very hard nosed.
Paying the rent.
So reputation means a great deal. I would say it means almost everything. And talent, and particularly original talent, is not. It's in the case of us, we hit a magic button. Mm-hmm. This guy from Texas, who I thought was a fool.
Yeah.
Wow.
He looked very innocent, and he was the first man. He put in $75,000, and he wrote a check in front of us.
Wow.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary, and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Now, going back, whose idea was Bye Bye Birdie?
Well, I think with the principals, one of whom is dead, you might get different answers. I give Mike Stewart, who wrote the libretto, and Lee, the most... Lee had the idea of a rock and roll singer. Mike typed the entire script almost the way it is now.
Wow.
In 10 days.
What?
Yeah.
And what a great librettist.
Yeah.
Oh, great Mike Stewart. And I don't think doesn't get the credit
underrated,
he deserves.
Underrated, yeah. For sure.
There's well, that,
he's rich and underrated.
Rich and underrated. Okay.
Yeah. Mike typed it in 10 days. The idea of Cheetah, I dare say, was my own, because it was written originally about a Polish girl. And it was Carol Haney was supposed to do it. She got sick. She was always getting sick. And Cheetah was an old friend of mine. We were in a review called the Shoestring Review.
Oh, yeah.
And so the idea was turned into a Spanish girl, which turned out to be prescient because they're now the biggest thing. So
exactly.
Yeah.
And it's going to be on NBC?
Yeah, with Lopez. With
That's amazing. Yeah. That should be very exciting.
Yeah.
I dream the dream of days to come where sponsorship is high and money is forthcoming.
That's beautiful, Kevin.
No, I really added a voice onto that one, too. I really was trying to go for something there.
Listeners, we love creating this podcast, but it does cost money. Please don't make me sell my Angel record.
Oh, my gosh. The original cast recording of Angel.
That, like, nobody has.
Nobody has it.
If you like what we are doing and want us to keep doing more of it, please head over to patreon.com.
What?
That's patreon.com.
Patreon.
Patreon.
Yeah,
Patreon.
Rion.
Patreon.
Yeah, and once you're there, search for Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends. And of course, we don't expect you to give without receiving some great rewards.
Such rewards include behind-the-scenes videos, shout-outs on future episodes, or episodes, depending on what part of the country you're from, because I said episodes, and early access to some of our podcasts. Hell, for the right price, Kevin and I will come to your apartment and act out all of Agnes of God.
So head over, friends, to P-A-T-R-E. O-N.com to help us out.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to ask about the music. So it's 1960. You're writing probably in the late 50s. The Beatles have not yet come to America. No. Pop music isn't exactly... It has never been on Broadway yet.
Yeah.
I feel like Bobby Birdie doesn't always get recognized enough for being one of the very first rock and roll musicals ever.
I agree.
And yet, how in the world did this classical musician who studied at Eastman School of Music with Nadia Boulanger and Copeland and, you know, write a pop score? I mean, how did you find that voice?
Well, it's an interesting... I admire myself.
I do too.
I listen to a lot of stuff. I listen, of course, to Presley when I was doing it, and... there was a comic, a wonderful man by the name of Dick Shawn.
Okay. Oh, yes.
And I used to play for Dick sometimes in his act. And Dick did a wonderful, "Ooh, baby, you're going." And I could do that. I picked it up.
Yeah.
And that in my soul, that kicked into it. He didn't write it originally, as I recall, about that rock aspect of it. And that plus the fact that Mike's genius, Lee's genius, and that we had a lot of experience writing in these reviews.
Right.
So it all came together. Gower, of course, who was a master in his own way, it was his first show. I mean, he had done, you know, a lot of nightclub stuff.
Right.
And we got him at the right time.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and got his in good work, too. Yeah.
You've worked with different lyricists throughout your career. So when in the terms of the relationship that you and Mr. Adams had together, it's such an obvious question, but what did you prefer? Did the lyrics come first and then you set those to music? Did you bring in the melody? And
It really varied. And it's a usual question. So many people seem interested in it. With Lee and me, I would say it was very much a collaboration in the sense that he liked me enough and liked himself enough that he would say, "I don't know, there's something about that note or something." And I, more likely because it's easier to talk about the English language than it is sometimes about to talk about an abstraction, was very tough on him as I wanted to be on myself. I said, "I think that's the wrong pronoun. I think that rhyme is forced. I love the idea, and it's in the, but it's all done in the first." I have a gift for it. As it turned out, I'm not a bad lyricist, and I'm taking a chance on my next show where I'm writing the lyrics too. Lee and I became like brothers. We still are. We're very close, although we've had a financial disagreement over the past 2-3 years, but it's all over now. It's been settled. Because Lee is very... I love Lee. I mean, he's like my brother. But Lee was very up and down about being in the business.
Mm.
He was basically a country boy. He wanted to live in the country. I couldn't dream of living in the country. I was born in New York City. I went to Deawood Clinton High School, and you know, I'm just a New York guy. And I would say we split up over that because I wrote Annie with Martin at a time when Lee walked away, not from me, but he moved to Connecticut, actually with his wife, whom he's divorced since, but I didn't like her particularly, but that wasn't it. He now had to, you know, I can catch the 6:14 if I leave now, and it just wasn't the same. And so I started to look for other things to do because I'm a real workaholic, and in doing that, Martin and I were old friends, and Martin and I, and then Tom Meehan, whom has gotten to be one of my best friends. Do you know Tom?
He's on our list.
We'd love to get him for this.
He's a lovely guy.
Because his hand has been everywhere, it seems, in the history of theater. I mean, he's been around.
Well, he was called a lot after Annie. But he is just a lovely man. He tells me now he's not feeling well. I'm going to see him this week. But he is just a terrific guy. And I'd like to think of him as one of my best friends.
That's fantastic.
He's a nice man. He's thoughtful. He's kind. He's very kind. And you know, when you're are either of you married?
Yes, we both are.
Yeah, you both are. Well, you know what it's like. You know, when you have differences with somebody, and then you have differences with somebody you love. There's a different way of doing it. You can be just as hard. Tom is such a loving and lovable kind of guy that. To be able to collaborate with him was nourishing.
Yeah.
And I think of him that way still.
I think that's special to have created a work of art, but also a friendship out of that.
I mean,
that's pretty.
I mean, I'm not sure he feels the same way, but I feel that way, yeah.
Now, Bye Bye Birdie becomes this, it's a huge hit.
Yeah.
It's a huge hit, your first time out of the gate on Broadway. Did you feel any pressure then that your next show had to live up to the same hype, or were you just concerned about telling a good story?
I think it goes with, well, there's nothing more pressurized than, you know, writing for Broadway. There's so much money, so many reputations that are gambled on it. So I think we felt terribly tense. However, Josh Logan came right in. He was Mr. Money himself.
Yeah,
yeah.
South Pacific, and Mel, who had been an old friend anyway, but it looked like a pretty. The money rolled in.
Yeah,
we had no. I think we played two or three what they called backers auditions, but it was basically for people who were going to put in money, but wanted to hear it.
You guys were the ones who had the big hit, so the next one would.
And this
and
is
Josh was, you know.
And the next show is All American.
That's what we're talking about. Yeah.
Which is one of our absolute favorites.
Love this.
Oh my God.
You're really the one. you're the one.
You know,
always have.
Please forgive my ignorance. Once Upon a Time is such a favorite of so many young men that are auditioning today. So we hear it really consistently. It's so there are lots of fans of the score out there, so
that's nice to hear.
Yeah, I mean,
Once Upon a Time was extremely heartfelt from Lee and me, and from my own experience, right before the writing of that show, I broke up with a young woman that I really loved a lot.
Yeah,
in fact, I still love her. She's dead now,
of course.
And I must say, I thought about her when we were writing song.
So. I'll never forget the first time I heard that song. I was a young man, but I was completely rocked by it. Didn't know that kind of music could exist with that kind of
music. Well, that's awfully nice.
Yeah, really, I remember exactly
what
it
was. But it really came from
here,
that's
for
me.
You know? Yeah. I mean, that's...
With Frank also.
Yeah.
Frank
of course.
Yeah. Oof. Okay. So then...
Oh, and Alan also. Alan learned.
Oh, he
Alan
was. That's where I read it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Was
Alan went to Dr. Jacobs, I remember.
Dr. Yes. Feelgood? Was that his?
Dr. Feelgood.
Dr. Feelgood. But Alan was... he was really... I loved Alan. I mean, I had so much fun with him. He's... oddly enough, he's been married so many times. But Barbara, my wife, always... There was something about him that turned her off. I don't know what it was, but... I enjoyed Alan so much. He knew he was dying 2 weeks before the word came in. He still went to Turnbull and Asser and bought a dozen custom shirts. He was incredible. I was not there when he died. In a stupid kind of way, I felt rejected because there were friends in the room. Mm. But everyone told me, and I believe it about Alan, that he ordered champagne for everybody. He knew it was it, you know. And, that's the way he was.
Yeah, yeah.
What a great way to go.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, might as well make a party out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I have to ask a question about a woman who was on the music team for All American. We've talked about her a lot on our podcast because I feel like she had this whole career in music theater as a dance arranger and a music arranger. And she did the incidental music. Her name's Trudy Rittman. Remember?
Yes.
Yeah. She's unknown in our business these days. And
well,
she was
an older woman at the time.
Even then, I feel like she was always like this sort of older lady. Yeah.
Very sweet woman.
Right? But women working in the Broadway world, there weren't a lot of jobs. Not a lot of women worked on that side of it.
Well, as accompanists, there were, because a lot of serious pianists, they weren't doing concerts. And
right.
They became that. But I'm very proud of the fact that on Birdie, which was our first show, we not only had a woman conductor, the first, as far as I know, but she was a black woman.
Oh, my goodness.
Joyce Brown was the first conductor. And although I've heard other people say, oh, we had the first, as far as I know, Joyce Brown was the first woman conductor and the first black woman.
I'm writing that down.
Very good friend. She was a terrific pianist. And I thought to myself, look, I'm a New Yorker, and so the idea of color line is out of my world.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
I mean, except for recognition. Joyce, who started out being the pianist, she took.
That's awesome.
Me.
I didn't know that. I did not know that, and I want to look her up.
Yeah, well, I'm very really proud cool. of it. But it was nothing on my part. I just loved her. She was a terrific musician.
And qualified. And
she was very qualified, and she knew how to boss people, which you got to do. Yeah.
Huh. You know, as a composer, do you enjoy arranging the dance music or enjoy creating the vocal, you know, the big choral sections, or is that something that you're happy to pass off to somebody else?
I enjoy it, but I enjoy it after the fact, it's very hard work.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, if you're really going to write for chorus, you have to voice it and all. And I confess to, on certain shows, and usually the shows have not been as successful, it was handed off to the assistant music director or the guy who was just, playing.
Yeah.
No, I really enjoy it. I was trained as a composer, so the idea of voicing a chord a certain way is appealing to me.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, totally.
Really interesting. What's it like working with Ray Bolger?
It's a hard question to answer because he existed in with his wife's holding him up in a sense. It's funny. I hadn't thought of it that way. Wasn't he the scarecrow in...
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was the scarecrow.
I had never said this or thought about it even, but he kind of knew what he wanted, but he had a very strong-willed wife who was always there in the background, who would kind of give us the orders. And so I think of him that way as not having... He was not our choice, by the way. We definitely did not want him. It was... we wanted somebody else... And Josh wouldn't. I even went to London to, and that was the guy who had played we just saw it again the other night. I got to pick a pocket.
Ron Moody.
What?
Ron Moody.
Ron Moody
from Oliver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was a part of a immigrant, and I even flew to London. I had other things to do, and I met Mr. Moody, and he was very excited. Josh wanted Ray Bolger. They had done Where's Charlie together, and we couldn't talk Josh out of him.
And that was it.
Yeah.
You know, Were you, this sounds like a weird question, but you know, you're working with Joshua Logan, you're working with people who had been in the business a little bit longer than you. Did you get intimidated, or were you able to...
Gower intimidated you. And it was his first show, too.
I was going to say.
Gower was a very, very tough guy, and brilliant, as everybody knows.
Yeah.
But yeah, he intimidated me. No, I would... Oh, Sammy intimidated me a lot. Sammy Davis.
Yeah.
Which was funny because we were of similar ages and I can't say similar backgrounds, but we were both, you know, New Yorkers.
Yeah.
He wasn't born rich. I wasn't born rich. But he intimidated me. And looking back on it, I would say a lot of it was my fault because I was a little bit cocky and, you know... The opening song, as I remember in Golden Boy, is "Summer, not a bit of me." And about the third performance, he started going "Summer, not." It was actually very effective, and nobody noticed it, but I noticed it.
Of course,
look, I was right out of Eastman School of Music.
Right, and now he's got all these other notes with the melody. Yeah. And
so I made the mistake of. Approaching him that way one day with a yellow notepad, no less. And it was a big mistake in many ways. And we finally made it up, but he never, ever took to me. Although he was very good to me and for me and made me a great deal of money. I mean, a show, we had a lot of flaws in it, but we ran for 3 years, 2 years here, and 3 years in London.
Wow. And
virtually never an empty seat. Just
I never realized that.
There were empty seats. And also, he might miss two performances a week every 2 months or something.
Yeah, right.
And he wasn't easy. But he had a typical, you know, black man's life.
Did he stay with that run the whole time?
He stayed with it. Missed a lot of performances.
But still, wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Wow. How did you get involved with Golden Boy?
Well, the show, we always had a liking of Clifford's play.
Yeah.
And actually, I think the man who produced it, I forget whether he brought it to us, but he talked Clifford into doing the libretto. Which is an interesting story. And by virtue of Clifford doing it, he was able to entice Sammy because Sammy wanted to be an actor.
Mm.
And when it was just us committed to it, Sammy was playing a lot of games.
Mm.
But when Clifford decided he would do the libretto himself, Sammy, who always wanted to be an actor, committed himself to it.
And Mr. Odets didn't finish writing the book, is that correct?
Clifford, I think, died, yes. Also, when we were in trouble, we brought in one of his students, William Gibson. So there were a lot of heads. It became very difficult to do because everybody saw it a little differently.
Yeah.
Was it?
I don't know if this is true or not. That out of town, the show it was a little edgier, it was a little darker, and then when it came into New York, that was a little bit more neutralized. Is that correct?
It may be, because I do know we had certain experiences. For instance, when we were in Philadelphia, and, you know, we did it, so the two of them, the man and the woman, she's white, he's black, make love. I mean, actually make love.
Yeah.
It was a fade out, but...
Sure.
And the hate mail we got in Philadelphia was so, so awful that we had to have police escorts from the theater every night.
Oh, my God.
Every night. They had Philadelphia cops taking us there. Mail, I couldn't believe that Americans would write, you know, we're going to get you. They were like Jews, you know.
Yeah.
Everything was thrown into
it.
There are people out there whom we now know.
Yeah.
Who don't like, you know, people who are to the left at all. I didn't consider that, but it was the first time that a black actor and a white actor touched. Yeah. They'd never even done that before, and we had them shacking up. You know,
that's incredible.
In 1964, I mean, like...
It's virulent, like you wouldn't believe.
And was Sammy Davis Jr., in real life, he was married to a white woman, is that correct?
Yeah, almost always. He went after he broke up with Mai, who was a really nice young woman, and she and my wife became very friendly. But like many men I have known, some quite well, you know, he was swinging all the time.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, a few times, and I don't think this is slanderous to say this, you know, would say, look, this is Lorraine. Would you stay with her in back, you know, with me? Well, I knew Lorraine wasn't as Asian.
Right.
So, yes, he was he was very active.
The Golden Boy Overture, which is the sounds of the boxer's breath, it's brilliant. Was that yours?
Yes, it's mine.
We've talked about this on a previous episode.
Oh, yeah.
We do a second show, which is we I don't want to say dust off, but we remind our audiences of the great musicals of the past they might not be as familiar with. And so Golden Boy was... Golden Boy... And we were talking about that overture is just such a cool way to start that show.
How does it...
It's using all of the sounds of the boxing ring.
It's the punching
to start up the music.
All very rhythmic.
So it's almost this percussive, aggressive...
That was Sammy in a way. I started it out that way. That was my idea, which I remember that because Sammy, when he did a joke on me, he broke himself up. And I said, look, here's an idea for the first song. And he said, how does it go? I was sitting, and I said, well, it's very hard to do, Sammy. He said, what? Do it. You know, we were good friends. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay. Don't swallow the mouthpiece. Well, he fell off the chair laughing because he wanted to hear, you know, and that was the overture. I wanted that sound of just the gym.
Yeah.
Punching.
It's sparring. I think it's one of the very few overtures that set up the musical so perfectly.
I do too.
And we love it. So yeah, we spent time
at gyms up in Harlem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I met a lot of boxers. I met Cassius Clay.
Dad's favorite man. Yeah.
Did he know
my
him?
Dad hung out with him a couple times. Yeah.
Oh, well, I only That's met cool. him once, so I can't talk about him. All the boxers are the nicest people. I never guessed it in the word because they get in the ring and they look like killers.
Oh yeah.
Cassius Clay was one of the sweetest young guys. You'd want to bring him home.
Yep.
To marry your daughter or something.
That's
he was
so
that
cool.
kind of a man.
That's so cool.
And when he died, I mean, you could tell how people loved him. But I only met him twice, and both on that occasion. We spent 2 days in Harlem with boxers who are, without doubt, the nicest group of people I've ever met. They're so gentle. And the reason being, they explained this to me, that when you're 6 years old and either poverty or some ambition for fame drives you to it, and you start to learn the art of boxing, you gain a tremendous respect and then love for your opponent.
Mm.
That it's real love. Yeah.
How interesting.
That they, when they embrace, they told me this, so I have to assume it's true.
Yeah.
When they embrace after this fierce fight, because I love boxing since I did the Golden Boy, that they really care about each other.
Yeah.
Arc of...
I believe that.
Yeah, it's something you don't hear, though, too often.
No, you don't.
Right?
You certainly don't.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. That's really, really interesting. Did you or Mr. Adams feel any unease about, you know, writing a story about an African-American man and an African-American journey and an African-American world? Or were you okay with that? Was there pressure? Did anyone say, what are these two white guys doing?
I felt uneasy sometimes. It was a black cast. And I do remember a song called No More, which went into the show late. And I remember teaching it to a black cast. And they were there were dead eyes on me.
Mm-hmm.
what the heck is he doing, you know, writing this, whereas it was very heartfelt from us. Yes, I did feel it sometimes. But I had been, you know, I went to New York public schools.
Yeah.
And I had gone out, I had with black girls.
Yeah.
So I, in that respect, I was new. But there, I did feel that, even from Sammy, sometimes.
Yeah.
There was that line that even though he wanted to be kissing cousins, and there was a kind of thing that I was still a white man. And,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. That's really interesting. Yeah. I didn't know it had such a long run, though, in London. That I was not aware of.
Yeah.
Than in the UK.
I think 3 years.
Then, after Golden Boy, comes another one of everybody's favorites. Boy, Charles Strauss is really everybody's favorite composer.
It's true.
It really, we're not saying that just to be nice. It's very true. Nice.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.